Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a warm welcome to today's broadcast, a special one as it focuses on the final day of Benedict XVI's pastoral journey to the United Kingdom. One which ended with its centrepiece as the Pope presided on Sunday morning over the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman. The significance of this event is underlined by the fact that it was the first time that the Holy Father personally beatified a person since his election to the papacy. The four-day visit began in Scotland on Thursday, 16th of September, as the Pope met at Holyrood House with the Queen before making his way to Glasgow in the evening to celebrate his first open-air Mass in a crowded and joyful Bellahouston Park. A long day which came to an end as he flew into London that same evening, in time for a series of significant encounters. The first on Friday morning at St. Mary's University College in Twickenham focused on Catholic education, but also included a meeting with religious leaders and people of faith. His Friday afternoon appointments included a historic visit to Lambeth Palace, the Archbishop of Canterbury's residence, as well as a keynote address at Westminster Hall and a moving celebration of evening prayer at Westminster Abbey. On Saturday, the third day of his visit, he presided over Mass in Westminster Cathedral, the Mother Church of England and Wales, where, during his homily, the Pope expressed deep sorrow and shame for the cases of sexual abuse on the part of the Catholic clergy. And indeed, later in a personal meeting with five victims of clerical sexual abuse, he pledged the Church would do all in its power to investigate cases of abuse and safeguard the young. On a more joyful note, Saturday evening ended as Benedict XVI joined the crowds for a prayer vigil in Hyde Park, entering into the mood for the beatification ceremony on Sunday in Birmingham's Cofton Park. Philippa Hitchin is travelling with the Pope and filed this report.
A man of gentle scholarship, deep wisdom and profound love for the Lord. That's how Pope Benedict described the great 19th century theologian John Henry Newman as he presided at the Beatification Mass in a windy Cofton Park, less than a mile away from the spot where his earthly remains were laid to rest. Descendants of Newman's family and the American deacon Jack Sullivan, whose miraculous healing from a crippling spinal disorder had been a key part of this beatification process, mingled with the huge crowd that had been gathering on the grassy slope since the early hours. A giant portrait of the elderly cardinal dominated the simple white dome set up over the altar, where bishops from across England, Scotland and Wales sat to hear the Pope pronounce the words that so many of them had been longing to hear.
By our apostolic authority we declare that the venerable servant of God, Cardinal John Henry Newman, priest of the Congregation of the Oratory, shall henceforth be invoked as blessed, and that his feast shall be celebrated every year on the 9th of October in the places and according to the norms established by church law. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
As he began his homily, the Pope noted that this day of Newman's beatification coincides with the 70th anniversary of one of the key moments of World War II, the Battle of Britain, where the nation's air forces repelled a sustained German bombing attack on cities across the country.
For me, as one who lived and suffered through the dark days of the Nazi regime in Germany, it is deeply moving to be here with you on this occasion, and to recall how many of your fellow citizens sacrificed their lives, courageously resisting the forces of that evil ideology. My thoughts go in particular to nearby Coventry, which suffered such heavy bombardment and massive loss of life in November 1940.
Returning to the legacy of the newly beatified founder of the nearby Birmingham Oratory, the Pope recalled how throughout his long life the saintly Englishman had applied his keen intellect and his prolific pen to the most pressing questions of his day.
His insights into the relationship between faith and reason, into the vital place of revealed religion in civilized society, and into the need for a broadly based and wide-ranging approach to education were not only of profound importance for Victorian England, but continue today to inspire and enlighten many all over the world.
In particular, the Pope noted just how much Newman's vision for education has shaped the work and ethos of Catholic schools and colleges today.
Firmly opposed to any reductive or utilitarian approach, he sought to achieve an educational environment in which intellectual training, moral discipline, and religious commitment would come together.
As the Pope pointed out, Newman is best known around the world for his intellectual legacy, his writings which have so profoundly influenced both the Anglican and Catholic traditions. But, he said, it's the simple warmth and humanity of this much-loved man during his years of ministry among the people of Birmingham that caused so many thousands of mourners to line the streets for his funeral in August 1890. As members of the British royal family commemorated the Battle of Britain in London's Westminster Abbey, Pope Benedict urged Christians to take up Newman's struggle to save the soul of the nation, enabling the kindly light of faith to shine and to guide the steps of all people in these lands. In the United Kingdom, with Pope Benedict, I'm Philippa Hitchin.
But who exactly was John Henry Newman? Monsignor Roderick Strange, author of John Henry Newman, A Mind Alive, sat down with me in our studios here for a chat. My aim was to find out more about this august figure in an effort to draw out Newman's relevance today. Stay tuned. Doing some browsing in your local bookshop any day soon? If you do, you might just come across a book by the title of John Henry Newman, A Mind Alive. You won't miss it. It has a sepia-coloured photograph of an intense-looking Newman on the cover. A photograph which, in my opinion, conveys two things. First of all, that mind alive, enhanced by that sharp glint of the eyes, but also a warmth, an intimacy, as this august figure leans, arms crossed, towards, well, us, really.
The mind was alive not because he was some icy intellectual locked in a tower, but because he didn't want to move minds without touching hearts.
Newman in a nutshell. As the author of the book, Monsignor Roderick Strange, currently rector of the Pontifical Bader College here in Rome, remarked to me. A Newman expert, this Rome-based Monsignor, paints a vivid and nuanced portrait of this Englishman, who happens to be one of the most significant and enigmatic figures of the 19th century. One already proclaimed venerable in 1991. I invited Monsignor Strange to join me here at our studios. He sat down with me to speak about his book. But before letting you enjoy this conversation, I'd like you to listen to a couple of lines from page one of the book, a quotation of Newman's about God's hidden saints and their influence.
Say they are few, such high Christians, and what follows. They are enough to carry on God's noiseless work.
He himself said, you know, that you don't have to call Whitey Brown white when you're talking about the saints. And Pope Benedict, in January 2007, spoke about the fact that people are canonized doesn't mean that they've never made mistakes.
Perché vediamo i santi non sono caduti santi dal cielo. Erano uomini come noi, con problemi anche con peccati. Ma...
They've not fallen from heaven.
They're not fallen from heaven. They've got problems. One of the things which could be valuable about Newman being beatified would be that he would be an example to people who struggle, whose lives are a bit complicated, a bit messy at times. And that's all right. You know, it's really the way we handle the mess rather than having everything perfect all the while.
Getting on to the scholarly side of things, on the cover of your book, I read his... personality remains elusive. What does that mean?
It's a way of referring to the complexity of the personality. You know, somebody who was, in many ways, quite solitary, very happy in his own company, and yet also a man who had a great capacity for friendship, got on well with all sorts of different people. There's a book written by a friend of mine, Joyce Sugg, which is really based on the letters that Newman wrote to a whole range of women friends, rather aristocratic ladies, ordinary women, his sisters, some nuns, a whole range of people. Great capacity for friendship, for engaging with people.
Yeah, he's best known as a scholar, really, isn't he?
That's what people remember, or people often associate him with. But one of the things that I think is interesting about Newman is the way in which the scholarship was always what he called occasional, not in the sense that he just did it from time to time, but in the sense that it was provoked by, prompted by particular occasions, particular needs. So there was always something very, very practical, very immediately pastoral about what he was concerned with. He had this saying, which I love, about not wanting to touch people's minds without moving their hearts, which is, I think, is at the very centre of what he was concerned with. To be real, to touch people where they really... where the problems existed.
He lived at a time when you didn't speak about that sort of thing too much, no? Touching people's hearts for somebody of his standing.
Yeah,
not in Britain, anyway.
Perhaps not in some ways, though I suppose, you know, when you think of the Victorians, there's a tremendously rich literary tradition. Think of the great novelists of that time, the Trollope and Dickens and so forth. And theology and literature were very much interwoven in the 19th century. So that would have been sort of part of the air that he breathed, and therefore to touch people, to bring things home to people in a more immediate way was important for him.
So he was very complete in a sense, because you said he was human, he was saintly, you know, having erred sometimes.
Yeah.
Then he was a theologian, and he was a literary figure as well.
Very much, yes.
And a musician, no?
And indeed a musician. He loved music and played the violin.
So he was a good parish priest as well.
He was a good parish priest. The people who know not too much about him tend to make a much too oversimple contrast between himself and the other, his contemporary as a cardinal, Henry Edward Manning. Manning was the Archbishop of Westminster, also a convert Anglican clergyman. There are all sorts of parallels between their lives. But people tend to think of Manning as being the administrator and the practical man, and Newman the more reclusive theoretical scholar. The caricature isn't fair to either of them.
And perhaps this is because people haven't really read Newman.
More recently, perhaps not, yes. When you read books about Newman, quite often writers say that Newman was such a beautiful writer that they are going to leave him very often to speak for himself. Now, there are plenty of quotations in the book, but I've tried to break down, by and large, the big block quotations so that people reading the book will find it easier to get into and to understand what he was saying.
Your book offers a profile of a thinker, friend, and a priest. Which comes first for you, personally?
Personally?
Now the book's published.
Now the book's published. Newman has been, since I was a student here in Rome over 40 years ago, a real influence on my life. Not the only influence, but a significant influence on my life.
Why is that?
I think because when I started to read him, first of all, I thought his life story was very interesting because it's a story of expectations quite often not being fulfilled. He was expected to do very well as an undergraduate, but virtually failed his degree. And then, surprisingly, he was made a fellow of what was regarded as the top Oxford College at the time when he became a don at Oriel, and then becoming involved in the Oxford movement, but then, in fact, becoming a Roman Catholic, and then the various problems that he had as a Catholic, sort of various crises that arose. So it's quite an exciting story in its way. That was one thing. And then another aspect was when I started to read Newman, it was during the Second Vatican Council in the mid-1960s. And that was a time, as you know, when the church here in Rome was coming to grips in a fresh way with a sense of local churches. And here was Newman, a quintessentially English figure. So he was fascinating for me as a young man preparing for priesthood in that way. And also what we've already talked about, that strong pastoral drive that really shaped everything that he did. He wasn't just a remote academic. I make the point in the book that although the subtitle is A Mind Alive, the mind was alive not because he was some icy intellectual locked in a tower, but because he didn't want to move minds without touching hearts and being involved with people.
And what's his legacy to the average Catholic today?
His legacy to the average Catholic today, average is always difficult, isn't it? But his legacy to the average Catholic, I think, would be but to help them perhaps understand questions which they might puzzle over, whether they're questions of authority or the significance of Our Lady in ecumenical discussion, the place of the laity in the church.
You have chapters about that,
chapters
don't you?
Chapters about that.
And, you have Mary, but also Mother of Jesus, serving the laity.
Yeah, but also, I think, attitudes to spirituality and just the example of faithfulness when things are difficult.
He was an Anglican who was received in the Catholic Church in 1845, I believe. He
yes.
had a profound influence both on the thinking of Anglicans and Catholics, no?
He has had. I mean, obviously, there'll be both Anglicans and Catholics who are not impressed by him or not particularly enthused by him. People who find him too particular or too fussy, and that's all right.
But in chapter 7 you talk about seeking church unity.
Mm, yes, and particularly what I tried to show in that chapter is the way in which after Newman had become a Roman Catholic, after he'd left the Church of England, he remained particularly in regular contact with Edward Pusey, who had been a close friend of his as an Anglican, and they had been involved very much in the Oxford movement, which was a movement to help the Church of England retain and develop its Catholic tradition. Newman became a Catholic, Pusey remained an Anglican, but they remained good friends, and they discussed matters. In particular, they got involved in a controversy about the way in which doctrine and teaching and devotion to the Blessed Virgin should be handled. But the fascinating thing is, although that they were holding, on the one hand, a public debate, they were also writing to each other privately. It's a wonderful example of people who, on the one hand, are conducting a public debate, and I don't mean in a secretive way, but in fact are in contact privately and trying to work out how to handle the dispute in the most constructive fashion.
In an era of letters.
An era of letters rather than emails. But it's also a warning, because they didn't get all that far with it, but that personal trust is a vital feature in all ecumenical relationships, as in all human relationships, really.
In chapter 3 of your book, you speak about how Pope Benedict XVI viewed Newman both as Pope and as former Cardinal. What kind of influence do you think this great blessed-to-be then had on his thinking?
Well, I think one influence, which the Pope has spoken about some years ago when he was cardinal here in Rome, was how, as a young seminarian just after the Second World War, he valued Newman's teaching on conscience And he's spoken movingly about the importance, it's absolutely fundamental to Pope Benedict, isn't it, of the importance of reason, not in the narrow, sort of dry intellectual sense, but that we should be reasonable, we should explore and try to discover objective truth, that if everything becomes relative, then it's not that, well, you can think what you like and I can think what I like and everything is free, but on the contrary, it will mean that the people who have power force their own conclusions on people. And that, of course, was precisely the experience that he had had as a boy in Nazi Germany. So that he has spoken about Newman as articulating, so to speak, an alternative to that dictatorship that he had experienced when he was young.
Give me a good reason why anyone should read your book. What, in your opinion?
I hope that when people read it, that they will find that it's not nearly as difficult to read as they might have expected. That, if you like, Newman's friendly face on the cover is in fact quite a good sign of what they're going to find inside. And that from the book they will discover something of him as a human being, something of the way in which he thought about matters which are still crucial for us in the church today. And because there is a personal element there, in other words, I've mentioned from time to time ways in which what he has said have been of help to me, then they may be able to transpose that and see, not that he would necessarily help them in the way that he's helped me, but that this is not just some figure from the distant past, but somebody who really does have something which is significant for us still today.
You were listening there to Monsignor Roderick Strange, author of John Henry Newman, A Mind Alive. Finally, why don't we join historian Stella Fletcher in the church of San Giorgio al Velabro, which was once Cardinal John Henry Newman's titular church here in Rome. Stella also shares with us a visit to a place especially linked to our new blessed. We're in San Giorgio al Velabro, which is linked to John Henry Newman.
On my right, over on that far wall, there's a plaque that says that John Henry Newman was cardinal of this church. Each cardinal has a titular church, and this was Newman's church. He came to Rome in 1879, when he was an old man, born in 1801, so he was already pretty old, and he came to Rome to receive his red hat. Time the cardinals were given their titular churches. Now, Newman wanted a different church altogether in a very poor area. And another cardinal got that, so Newman was offered yet another one. Finally, the English community in Rome secured this church for Newman. Why? Because St. George is the patron saint of England, and it was thought to be terribly appropriate. However, when Newman was here in 1879, he was in poor health. I think he was frequently in poor health, delicate type. And on his way here, caught a cold in Pisa. By the time he reached Rome, it was pneumonia. And he never actually set foot in this beautiful church. But I was determined to come here to talk about Newman because A few years ago, I was very fortunate in going to the Oratory in Hagley Road, Birmingham, where Newman lived for decades in the second half of his life. And there they have kept his rooms exactly as he left them. And one thing struck me in particular, and that was a picture of this church on the wall. He never came here, but he knew that this was his church, and he kept it by him and presumably kept it in his prayers for the rest of his life. During that visit to Birmingham, a most extraordinary thing happened. I was most surprised. I was taken into a side room where there were no windows, there was a wardrobe and cupboards, and my friend opened the wardrobe, and there were all these red cardinal's robes hanging there, virtually unused, and a row of red cardinal's shoes. It was fascinating. I was able to touch some of this red silk, which looks very much like the red silk in the famous portrait of Newman by Millet. Newman came to Rome on two separate occasions. I've already given an account of the second visit. The first visit came shortly after his conversion to the Catholic Church. He was already a well-known member of the Church of England. He was the vicar of the University Church in Oxford, and therefore terribly, terribly influential. But after he became a Catholic in 1845, he was required to be re-educated. Now, he was extremely well-educated already, but the Catholic Church didn't really know what to do with him. There wasn't a tradition of Anglican priests becoming Catholics and wanting to carry on in the priesthood. So Newman was sent here to Rome, to the College of Propaganda Fide, to study with students half his age or even younger, and he would fall asleep in the lectures, and he knew an awful lot more than the lecturers themselves. It was a discipline for him. Finally, he was ordained, and he took up the suggestion of Cardinal Wiseman, the first Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster, and became an Oratorian, a member of the Congregation of the Oratory, and was sent back to England in 1848 to start an oratory in Birmingham, because that was a growing city, and Newman felt that the Oratorians could really make a difference in an urban context. And he also liked the Oratorians because they allowed time in the course of the day and in the course of the week for study, for writing, and for music. He said the Jesuits, they weren't for him. The Jesuits were like the ancient Spartans. But the Oratorians, they were like the ancient Athenians.
And that brings me up to time. On the final day of Pope Benedict XVI's pastoral visit to the United Kingdom. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Laudetur Jesus Christus.